keeping a nature journal do for us?
Keeping a journal that involves drawings, involves writing, involves counting, measuring, asking questions is an incredibly powerful way to get yourself to observe the world around you in more depth and clarity than you otherwise would. There are fascinating aspects of the world that come alive to me specifically because I am journaling. So I'm not journaling to try to make a pretty picture. If I get a pretty picture, that's great. But the drawing itself is actually a tool in service of observation, in service of memory, and in service of wonder.
That's John Muir Laws, a naturalist and environmental educator who's been called the modern Audubon. We talk with him about his book, The Law's Guide to Nature Drawing and Journaling. Then we talk with author Corinne Smith about another great lover of nature, Henry David Thoreau. Her latest book about the great 19th century writer is Henry David Thoreau for Kids, His Life and Ideas with 21 Activities. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. For John Muir Laws, paying attention is an act of love. Love for the plants, animals, and insects with whom we share our beautiful and terribly endangered home. Perhaps, no, surely, if we all paid the kind of attention that Laws does to the world that sustains us, we would be incapable of inflicting the monstrous harm on it that we do. The instrument of his love is his nature journal. John Muir Laws has been keeping nature journals since he was a child, roaming the California wilderness. His first published book is an illustrated guide to part of that wilderness, The Laws Field Guide to the Sierra Nevada. He went on to write more books, Guides to Birds, Guides to Drawing Birds, and now The Laws Guide to Nature Drawing and Journaling. It's filled with stunning drawings and practical exercises for developing your eye, hand, and mind for a deeper understanding of the natural world, whether that be in a spectacular national park or just in your own backyard. But the book is also more than a guide to drawing. It's a guide to living with more attention, appreciation, and love for what surrounds us. Well, John Muir Laws, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's a pleasure to be with you this morning.
Now, this is just a stunning book, The Laws Guide to Nature Drawing and Journaling. Before we talk about the book, though, I'd like you to tell us a little bit about yourself. I mean, you have an amazing name. It's almost as if you were born to this. Tell us, how did you get into this field of being a naturalist?
Well, both my parents were very interested in nature. Their entire courtship was following each other through meadows and valleys in the Sierra Nevada mountains. My dad was an amateur bird watcher, and my mom was an amateur botanist. So between the two of them, our family rambles would always be filled with nature discoveries and rolling over logs and looking for pollywogs in bogs and those sorts of things. And I think I got the bug from them. And just being exposed to nature on a regular basis as a child had a very profound impact on me. I was named John Muir Laws, actually not after the naturalist John Muir, but both John and Muir were family names, but they were quite aware of the way that those two things came together. My mom, for instance, was a lawyer for the Sierra Club. But I'm not an actual descendant of John Muir, although as a kid I thought I was, because even my own grandmother was giving me books about John Muir. And so I just grew up reading the stories of this crazy naturalist of, you know, there's a windstorm, what do? You climb to the top of the tallest tree to experience it. And that just sort of seemed perfectly natural to me, and it made sense. This guy must be a relative.
That's great. So now, how did you become a naturalist? What was the process? Did you come to it first as an artist, or did you come to it first as a scientist?
I think my entry point was, well, they actually kind of, those two things developed kind of in close proximity to each other, so I can't quite parse out which came first. but how they kind of intertwined is an interesting story in itself. As I mentioned, the sort of the background of being out there in nature was something that my parents, a seed that my parents planted in me. But when I was going through school, I was really struggling. I'm dyslexic. And in those days, that really wasn't something that was on teachers' radar. And so academically, I was failing. And I was terrified of writing, because any time I wrote something, it came back covered with red pen. But exploring in nature was where I went to find peace and find connection, and kind of I could get away from the book and into this absolutely fascinating real world, and I wanted to keep notes about it. So what I did is I drew pictures of everything that I saw. My mom put my first nature journal into my hand. She had watched on a family botany trip how I followed a sketcher around a field, and just every time she'd sit down and draw, I stood there looking over her shoulder. The next time we went out together, my mom had the same kind of sketchbook and the same set of pencils. She put those into my hands, and it just did not stop from there. And so I would, after school, I would grab my journal. I would go running through the park that was between my house and home and draw and sketch everything that I saw. And anything that you just do on a regular basis, you get better at it. And that was my way of connecting with the world.
Wow, it's wonderful. I mean, you've actually been called a modern Audubon, which is quite an honor.
It's quite an honor. I don't know if I can live up to it, but I do appreciate the thought. I in my own kind of corner of California here, am out drawing and sketching in nature as often as I can. And it is a real powerful way to get yourself to observe more carefully and see more beauty in the world, the same way that Audubon did.
Now, your book, I think just about the first sentence in the book is a question that you ask right at the front: why keep a nature journal? So why keep a nature journal?
I think the biggest misunderstanding about it is that people will think of a nature journal as a sketchbook that you keep in nature. And the purpose of a sketchbook is to make sketches and to draw pictures. I do draw and I do sketch, but actually the pictures themselves are not my goal. If I end up making a drawing that's a pretty picture, that's great. And if it doesn't happen, that's great. The reason that I sketch, and the reason that this activity has absolutely intoxicated me, is that keeping a journal that involves drawings, involves writing, involves counting, measuring, asking questions, is an incredibly powerful way to get yourself to observe the world around you in more depth and clarity than you otherwise would. It also dramatically improves your ability to remember what you've experienced. And the other piece of it is that as you start to kind of get your ideas and observations and questions down on a page in front of you, when you externalize all the stuff that is going on in your head, and you give yourself a chance to see those ideas side by side, your brain can start to make connections between things in ways that it otherwise would not. And there are fascinating aspects of the world that come alive to me specifically because I am journaling. So I'm not journaling to try to make a pretty picture. If I get a pretty picture, that's great. But the drawing itself is actually a tool in service of observation, in service of memory, and in service of wonder. That's my goal. And the journal is just the most powerful tool that I've ever found to help me get into that state where the world opens up.
Yeah, you have some really beautiful thoughts and words in the beginning and the start of the book, The Law's Guide to Nature Drawing and Journaling. You actually draw a connection between paying attention and love. Could you make that connection for us?
I would love to. So I spent most of my life as an environmental educator, trying to teach people about nature, trying to help people fall in love with the natural world. And in doing that, I realized, you know, you'd better come up with a working definition of what love is. And as difficult to pin down as that is, I think I actually have a really useful working definition. So try this on and see what you think about it. And I think this applies both to, you know, our love of the natural world and think about your relationship with your children or your partner. Love is sustained, compassionate attention. So I'm not talking about that sort of falling in love thing, which is more of a trick of our biochemistry to get us to pair bond long enough to reproduce our species. But the love that comes from being in a place and really knowing it deeply, from being with another, your child, your partner, it's through that attention that you are transformed and they are transformed. And being able to keep that caring attention and focus, it takes work and it's difficult to do. But the more that you can get yourself to look and to look and to look and to really be present with someone or something or a place, that place becomes part of you. That place changes who you are. That person who you're connecting with changes who you are. That's why I guess people fall in love with their therapists. It's the first time that somebody actually paid attention to them. But you give that attention to something or someone, and it's utterly transformative to both of you.
Yeah, that's so true, I think. And so you're now making the connection between that paying attention and then falling in love with nature. In fact, you say that you fall in love with each species that you draw.
That's right. People often ask me, what is your favorite animal? Do you have a favorite plant? What is your favorite thing in nature? What is your favorite place? It very often is just, I'm rather fickle that way. And, I will be walking through the meadow and I'll find a spider. And you start to look at this spider and magnify it and explore its web, and it becomes utterly fascinating. And I fall in love with that spider. And then I walk on down the trail, and there is a sparrow collecting nesting material. And you can get yourself to really pay attention, notice something about this sparrow that you've never seen before, and all of a sudden I'm falling in love with that sparrow. So it's when I was working on my field guide to the Sierra Nevada, I painted over the course of about 6 years nearly 3,000 watercolor paintings of the plants and animals of the Sierra Nevada. And my process for drawing the plants was I would fill my backpack up with granola bars and blank paper and take off to the mountains for weeks at a time and draw every plant that I would come across. And I would see a plant and sit down next to it and key it out and then make a very careful, detailed painting of it from life in the field. You couldn't just pick this thing and bring it into the shade, because by the time you were done, there was a relationship between you and that plant. And just leaving it wilted by the side of the trail just felt so wrong. So I would sit out in the hot sun with a big hat on and paint that thing, then fluff up the grasses where I was sitting. And by the time I was done with this process, sort of years into it, my practice even was to then turn to the plant, thank the plant, to thank the place I was in. I felt so grateful for that opportunity to have some sort of connection with that wild thing, with that place, that it didn't sort of seem like a stiff artificial gesture. It felt like just the most natural thing that you would do. And I was walking through the Sierra Nevada, falling in love with every little piece, one at a time. And by the time this entire process was done, my sense of responsibility for stewardship for nature, for wanting to make my life and my work be in service of connection, be in service of stewardship, had grown dramatically. So for me, that love born of attention planted deep seeds of stewardship and a sense of responsibility for the world in me. And that's what I hope the experience that other people can have by being in nature, by learning how to pay such deep attention, that our sense of connection and responsibility for this world will grow.
So needed, so needed. You know, it's funny, you talk about the difference between taking photographs versus drawing, and I have noticed, you know, I take as many photographs as the next person when I go to beautiful places, but it's almost as if as soon as I'm taking the photograph, it's like I've captured it, I'm done, and I move on to the next thing. It's almost like taking photographs is a way not to pay attention, because now I have it, and I don't have to remember it in any other way.
Isn't that an interesting feeling, that when that shutter clicks, you have this little sensation of, oh, I've got it now. Mm-hmm. I'll have this forever.
Right.
There was an interesting study where people were given cameras and sent through an art museum to take photographs of the pieces of art that they connected with and that moved them the most. And at the end of that, people were asked questions about what they photographed. And their memories of what they experienced were significantly less vivid, less detailed, than people who had just walked through the museum and looked at the things that moved them. There can be something that happens in our head when we go click, and you think you've got it. Now, actually, I might make a distinction here between what I think is going on with the snapshot, which is you see something like, click, okay, I've got it, versus what a photographer is doing. Very often a photographer, the process of the photography actually slows them down and makes them look again at patterns, makes them look at contrast. They can see light and composition in ways that many other people don't see. And because they're thinking of things through this, the lens actually helps them see beauty in places that they otherwise would not. Mm. So there, I think that camera can actually enhance your experience of learning to see. But if you're just going around and taking click, 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 without spending real time being present and observing in the moment, we think to ourselves, someday in the future, you know, I'll have the Joneses over for dinner and I'll have a slideshow and I'll relive this experience. But that really doesn't happen. And sometimes later on you're looking at your photographs, you're thinking, why did I take this picture? You know, very often you see a beautiful sunset and you say, oh, get a picture of it. And then you look at that later and you're like, no, that's not it. That wasn't it. If that camera clicking tells your brain that it's okay to stop paying attention, we're really selling ourselves short. What we want to do is instead to try to find a way to get ourselves to slow down and pay more attention. The people who study memory have found that attention is really the door to memory. That which you pay deep attention to, you're logging richly into your brain. So if pushing that button makes you think, oh, I've got it now, I don't really need to pay attention now, I'm on to the next thing, then you are selling your memory short. So it can be a useful tool, and I'm not somebody who says don't take pictures, but I would say be very aware of that tendency to have your brain say, okay, I'm done, I've got it, and now I can go on to the next thing. It's sort of a practical way of kind of, say, think of of our primate self moving through the forest. You know, you see something, and your brain goes like, you know, can it eat me? Mm-hmm. Can I eat it? And once you've got these basic things figured out, you're on to the next thing.
Right.
There's so much more richness there if you can slow down and peel back the layers. Try to see if there is something here in something very familiar to you, something that you've seen many times that is new to you. Can you find the new in the old? If you can get yourself to observe something that you have never seen before, then ask a question that you have never wondered about before, or if you have just taken the time to make your memory, your real memory of this, more vivid and rich, I think that is what opens the world to us.
Yeah, and that's kind of on to the next thing. I mean, you say that you use your nature journal for three reasons: to see, to remember, and to stimulate curiosity. So we've talked about the seeing and the remembering, and the curiosity is so interesting. As I was reading it in this book of yours, John Muir Laws, in The Laws Guide to Nature Drawing and Journaling, I kept on thinking of the concept of beginner's mind in Zen Buddhism. You know, the sense of just being aware and curious without imposing preconceived notions.
I would make room in my study for both your beginner mind and your expert mind to come out and play, because they're different and they're both good. Rachel Carson has this wonderful quote to help us sort of slow down and pay attention to things. She says, when you look at something to think of it, how closely would you look at it if you had never seen this before? How close would you look at it if you knew this is the last time that you would ever see this thing? And with that kind of freshness and tenderness, to wrap your observation around whatever it is that you see, I will intentionally think about what is new for me here. What can I observe that I have never seen before? So that's even in things that are familiar to me. You don't have to go see a species of bird that you've never observed before. You can take an American robin that we have all seen in our gardens for years and years, our entire life, and by looking at it again and again, see layers of curiosity in it, of discovery in it, that we have never seen before. All the prior experiences we've also had with robins and anything which we read about in books or anything which we learned about on a nature documentary or had seen from a previous encounter, that also can come into play. So part of my process is to intentionally ask myself, you know, I wonder, what am I curious about here? And also to say, what does this remind me of? What are things that I have experienced? What are other lessons that I've had that in one way or another can tie in with this experience? The more that your brain starts to make connections between all the different little disparate, strange little things that are stuck in our gray matter, the greater our potential for real creative connection with whatever we're looking at. So one interesting definition I've heard for creativity is your ability to draw the connections between seemingly disparate things. So you can make that also a part of your process in journaling. Part of the time, I want to look at something as naively as I can and sort of look at something as if it were completely fresh to me and see what comes up there. And at the same time, or maybe I'd say at a different time, I want to also look at it and bring to bear everything that I know about robins and get it on the table again and see how all this, how all these different pieces come together. Or maybe not just about robins. I'll be looking at the robin and I'll say to myself, is there anything either creative and playful or straight scientific that in one way or another kind of gets my brain to kind of go, well, that sort of reminds me of this. All those are kind of inspirations for creative thinking.
Yeah, you know, as I was reading some of your wonderful examples, I was saying to myself, gee, I would have never thought to have asked that question. And so then I thought, well, is this something that just comes with practice, or do you have to be a scientist to have that kind of breadth of questions?
So that I think is a really, really important question. I think it is learnable. I think it is trainable. I think we can get, and the reason I say that is because for myself, I find I have to be very intentional about prompting my curiosity. And when I do, I am startled by the wonderful things that bubble up. But very often, it is stuff that I have to intentionally prompt with my brain. So when I'm going out in the field, I have three major questions. What do I notice? What does that remind me of? And what do I wonder? So I notice, it reminds me of, and I wonder. Those three pieces are really, really critical. And the way I kind of get the I wonder part to be a little bit more vigorous and fun is you can take that. We all kind of, at one point in school, kind of learn those basic questions, who, what, where, when, why, and how. Mm-hmm. I can use those as prompts to get myself to think about things in nature. So the who questions are questions about identification. You know, what kind of bird is this? What sort of plant is this? Which mushroom out here in the forest do these mycelium under this log connect with? But that just identifying things, I think, is the shallow end of the pool. And the more that I get into the other sorts of questions, the more interesting things become. So what questions can start me to think about processes? You know, what is going on here? A when question starts me thinking about timing. When do the ducks come to the pond? When do they leave the pond? Those are questions I can often answer just by getting up a little bit earlier in the morning and bringing my watch with me. A how question starts thinking about what is the mechanism behind something. How does this work? The really difficult or the really more kind of provocative questions are the ones that are the most difficult to answer, and those are often the why questions. Because if I'm wondering when the ducks arrive at the pond and or when they take off from the pond, I get out there, I can watch and get my answer. But I cannot directly observe why something happens. But I may be able to infer my answer by looking at other sorts of clues in nature. So I'll often intentionally ask myself who, what, where, when, how, why. And recently, this isn't in the book, but I've recently kind of added a few other prompts. I was going through an international school, and I saw they had a list of kind of prompting questions on the wall, and I thought, wow, there's some really great stuff there. I want to steal some of those ideas, so I'll share it with you. Three kind of big ideas that kind of came through from looking at that. One was, what is our responsibility? How do I affect what's going on here, and do I have a responsibility to that? My kind of additional sense of deeper stewardship that I received from spending my time sketching and observing in nature ties directly into that. Another thing that they got me to think about is, how do I know what I know? So when I think about something, this characteristic is to do this, to intentionally think about, to reflect on, how do I know what I know? What is my evidence for that? Or am I just kind of going on, am I just sort of riffing off of, you know, something I heard before and kind of took it as from some authority, or do I actually have any evidence of my own for what I think? So that often is bringing me into some interesting new directions when I'm intentionally asking myself, how do I know what I believe? So that's my ideas about that are also now starting to appear in the pages of my journal.
That's wonderful. I mean, that is the question. It's almost what you're doing in this book is through the medium of being a naturalist, is teaching profound lessons about life, responsibility, and how we think.
The more that I see how those pieces come together, the more interesting and joyful and creative the process is. My earliest journals were basically a sketchbook. I would go out and I would draw pictures of something. Then I found that some observations were difficult to show with my sketches. And even though I was afraid of writing because of my dyslexia, it made a difference in my journaling to start to get those sorts of ideas down on the page as well. And now I see that the pages of the journal are the place for all of these different elements to come together, for written observations, for my sketches, for the questions that I have, for my thinking about how I'm thinking. So my metacognition, if you will, or reflection on how do I know that? What's my evidence for that? What are things that I'm just sort of taking on authority or taking for granted? What am I not thinking through? When I externalize it onto the page, all of a sudden I can have I've got a much more articulate picture of how I'm thinking about things, why I think what I do, and it becomes so much more fun. Hmm. This process it's incredibly playful and creative and rich and absorbing. It's a tremendous amount of fun. That just makes me want to do it more and more and more and more and share it with more and more people.
And we're so glad that you did. This is just a terrific book, a beautiful book, The Law's Guide to Nature Drawing and Journaling. The illustrations are amazing, the information and the perspective. And I want to thank you so much, John Weir Laws, for talking with us here.
It was a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Go to writersvoice.net for more about John Weir Laws' work, including his workshops, drawing videos, and his blog. Next up, Corinne Smith talks about her interactive book about Henry David Thoreau. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. As the spring ripens and the days grow warmer, families turn their thoughts to outdoor adventures. Research shows that bringing kids into nature creates a lifelong sense of wonder, the foundation of learning. What better way to do that than to involve kids in hands-on activities that foster their inner naturalist? Combine that with a lively biography of America's most famous nature lover, Henry David Thoreau, and you have a book that delights and instructs in nature and history at the same time. That's just what Corinne Smith has done with her book, Henry David Thoreau for Kids. Whether it's building a model of Thoreau's cabin, planting a garden, keeping a journal, or creating a sound map of a forest, the 21 activities in the book bring Thoreau and his ideas to life in a vivid and engaging way. Corinne Smith is a writer, speaker, and outdoor educator. Henry David Thoreau for Kids is her second book about the great American thinker. Her first was Westward I Go Free, Tracing Thoreau's Last Journey.
Corinne Smith, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca. It's great to be here.
Well, this was just a lovely book on Henry David Thoreau, Henry David Thoreau for Kids, His Life and Ideas, with 21 activities, wonderful activities, I have to say, for kids to do to really appreciate the world a little bit in the way that Henry David Thoreau inspired people to do. First, kind of orient us a little bit about Thoreau, his time that he lived in, and the place that he lived in?
Sure. First of all, even though most of us say his name Henry David Thoreau,
oh, yeah.
Evidence suggests that his last name was really pronounced Thoreau in his time, like you're doing a thorough job. A lot of us have been saying it wrong all these years, so it's hard to get your tongue to say it consistently the right way. So.
And that's right. I learned that also.
Both of us are going to say Thoreau, okay. And we know it's supposed to be the other way.
Okay. Thanks for correcting me, though.
That's just the way it is. Anyway, Henry David Thoreau, American author, naturalist, someone who we consider now to be an environmentalist before that kind of term was even thought of. And scientist wasn't even really a term they were thought of. They were considered natural philosophers instead. He lived in Concord, Massachusetts, 1817 to 1862. He was known as one of the Transcendentalists. Transcendentalism was a movement, sort of an anti-church-going kind of movement that was initiated by Ralph Waldo Emerson in his essay Nature in the 1830s. And they generally believed that you could get a spiritual experience by being out in nature, and that spiritualism was inside you and you could get a connection with nature. And Thoreau is most famously known for two major things. One is for living for 2 years, 2 months, and 2 days along the shores of Walden Pond in a house that he built himself that was 10 feet by 15 feet. Walden Pond, by the way, is within the borders of Concord. So he was only about a mile away from home. But he didn't live there consistently. He wasn't a hermit. He did walk back to town, and it was on one of these walks back to town that he encountered one of his other major things that he's known for, and that is for being put in jail for one night for not paying the Massachusetts poll tax. He was either picking up a shoe at the cobbler's or taking a shoe to the cobbler's. I forget which exactly. I'm not sure we know which one. And in July of 1846, and was approached by Sam Staples, the constable, who said, "Gee, you haven't paid your poll tax in years, Henry." This was a tax that every man had to pay who wanted to vote in Massachusetts or who was of voting age. Henry did not want to vote, and never voted in his lifetime, so he didn't think he had to pay the tax. And so he refused politely, and Sam said, "Well, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to put you in jail." So it was the county jail. Concord was one of the county seats at the time, big stone edifice with granite stones and iron pickets and that kind of thing. And someone overnight snuck into Sam Staples' place and paid the poll tax for him. We believe it was one of Thoreau's aunts who lived right across the common from the jail. And Henry was released the next day. But his episode in jail got a lot of reaction from people in town, wanted to know why he had done it. So he created a lecture explaining himself. This has come to be known as civil disobedience. Mm. So those are the two things that Henry's really known for by the general public. It's pretty much become part of the fabric of American culture, actually, for those two things. So civil disobedience, of course, then every time it's used in a term in our society now, you'd think of Thoreau, but also Martin Luther King Jr., and all the things that were going on with the civil rights movement of the 60s, Martin Luther King Jr. did read civil disobedience when he was in college and was very moved by it. And that, in addition to being attracted to the teachings of Gandhi, influenced Martin Luther King. Gandhi also had read Civil Disobedience while he was in either England or South Africa, and before he even got into India and the independence movement there. So it's quite a far-reaching story, and I don't know another American author or another figure from history who was not a political figure having that much of sort of ripple effect into our society.
Absolutely. My father, who was Dutch and only came to this country at the very end of World War II, was very influenced by Thoreau, as I think many people are. I mean, his impact has been incredible. You know, I'd love to, those are wonderful stories, and I'd like to go into them a little bit more deeply. But first, I'd like to ask you, this is your second book about Thoreau, is that correct?
It is. Kind of funny how that happens. But yes, I myself read Civil Disobedience when I was in 10th grade and Walden when I was in 12th back in the 1970s. And it stayed with me all these years, and I kind of put it aside, but I'd like to think that it was always in the back of my mind. And then I was living out in Illinois in the late 1990s, early 2000s. Someone showed me a March 1981 National Geographic issue that had an article by Professor William Howarth of Princeton University tracing all of Henry David Thoreau's journeys throughout his life. Now, he was a homebody mostly. He loved his hometown, very committed to Concord. And he did go to Maine a few times and Cape Cod and did lecture as far south as Philadelphia and did go up into Quebec once in 1850 with his friend Ellery Channing. But I saw this map where he had come out to the Midwest, right in the place where I was sitting practically, and I thought I had known everything about him. And so that started my own journey of following his 1861 trip from Massachusetts to Minnesota. And I didn't go by train and steamboat like he did, but I took different vacations and traveled along the different way that he went and saw some of the same things. And he had not gotten a chance to write about that trip when he came back to Concord in July of 1861. He was suffering from consumption, tuberculosis, and they didn't know how to treat it at the time. So he only had about 9 months to live and was working with his sister Sophia to firm up his manuscripts, but he never got to write about the trip to Minnesota. So I took it on as a project myself, and it was very interesting, very worthwhile. The book is called Westward I Go Free, Tracing Thoreau's Last Journey. It came out in 2012 and tells the story that he didn't have a chance to, really. And it sort of follows my journey along the way, too. It does seem kind of odd to try to follow in the footsteps of somebody who lived 150 years before you did. But eventually, even if you're following somebody else, eventually the adventure becomes your own. And you have your own experiences in addition to seeing theirs.
Well, that's a wonderful story. We're talking with Corinne Smith about her book, Henry David Thoreau for Kids. It combines a short biography with 21 activities for kids to do to bring them to a greater understanding of Thoreau's life. So he was quite a broad thinker, someone who, I believe you write that when Ralph Waldo Emerson delivered the eulogy to his friend Henry David Thoreau, he listed that Thoreau had been a teacher, a writer, a lecturer, a surveyor, a pencil maker, an activist, a natural philosopher, and an amateur yet detailed oriented scientist. That's quite a breadth, and yet it all hangs together in one philosophical whole. Tell us a little bit about how Henry became Henry.
These days, really, I think of him as all those things, but also at his core, a creative writer. Mm. I think that's one of the reasons, the primary reason, he went to Walden Pond. He had been very close to his brother, John, who was a few years older. And in 1839, they had taken a boat paddling trip up the Concord and Merrimack Rivers up into New Hampshire, spent some time together. They were very close. They had taught together at their own school for a time in Concord. And John sadly died of lockjaw. He cut his finger while he was sharpening a razor, and tetanus set in. And, you know, we all get tetanus shots these days. They didn't back then. And if you don't get that, then you perhaps will suffer from lockjaw. And it's evidently an awful way to die. It took him like a week and died in Henry's arms. How can you not be affected by seeing your best friend and your brother experience such a terrible thing? And Henry wanted to write about the trip that they had taken. That's why he went to Walden. He didn't really go to Walden intending to write a book about that experience. He went to write about the trip on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers, which he did while he was sitting next to another body of water. And I think he saw that he couldn't achieve what he wanted to achieve by being a writer, by staying at home. His home must have been pretty busy. His father, I think, was a quiet man and was in the pencil-making business. But his mother and his two sisters were very involved in the anti-slavery movement. They did harbor runaway slaves in their home at least once or twice that we know of. He had maiden aunts who lived in town who were over. They took in boarders. I think he needed to get away to find himself and also to figure out his own writing process, and found out a lot of other things along the way. The family was always interested in nature. He and John would take their students out on field trips, which was kind of unheard of then, and explored Concord and picked huckleberries, and he taught them basic surveying and took them out on the boat, and so was a hands-on teacher more than most teachers did then. Did go to Harvard. The only thing that he said good about Harvard was that it had a great library. And he could read on his own and study on his own, learn some languages that he wanted to read. I also think, seeing this from the 21st century perspective and all of the press lately, that introverts have gotten, with Susan Cain's book called Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. She only mentions Thoreau once, but if you read her book, you can, and you have him in mind, you can see that he was probably closer to the far end of the introvert scale. He didn't go to a lot of parties. He didn't associate with people. He had close friends that he was good with, but a lot of times he wanted to go off on his own. And an introvert likes to go out and be in nature and gets recharged and re-energized by being around natural elements and the plants and the animals and paying attention to them, rather than being around a lot of people with small talk. That just wasn't his thing. So those are some aspects of him that I see. And he didn't gain fame in his lifetime. He did write two books, and then after he died, a couple more came out, his travel narratives about going to Canada and Maine and Cape Cod came out after he was gone. But he wasn't famous in his lifetime. He didn't go places and people said, oh, wow, there's Mr. Thoreau. That wasn't the way it was. So if he knew that we were talking about him now, and that if he knew how much his image came into American culture in the 1960s, for example, and 1970 with Earth Day, and the environmental movement, and the civil rights movement, and women's rights, all of those things swirling around in the 60s seemed to bring him back and bring his words on posters and greeting cards and all kinds of things. There was even a stamp in 1967 that had an artistic rendition of his portrait on it by American artist Leonard Baskin. Looks kind of craggy, but it was artistic, and it was...
I remember that.
Yeah, it was the 150th anniversary of his birth. Next year is the 200th anniversary of his birth, and people are already planning things. He would be mystified, maybe even embarrassed. But it just goes to show how much his words that he chose so well. He wrote 7 drafts of Walden before he was satisfied that it was the book he wanted to write. He was so careful with them that they still resound and still seem relevant to us today, which is an amazing feat for any writer.
We're talking with Corinne Smith about her book, Henry David Thoreau for Kids, His Life and Ideas with 21 Activities.
And just apropos of that, I was just about to read a little quote from Walden, or Life in the Woods, as the book is called, because I want to ask you a question pursuant of that. So he says, "Sometimes in a summer morning, having taken my accustomed bath, I sat in my sunny doorway from sunrise till noon, wrapped in a reverie, amidst the pines and hickories and sumacs, in undisturbed solitude and stillness, while the birds sang around or flitted noiseless through the house, until by the sun falling in at my west window, or the noise of some traveler's wagon on the distant highway, I was reminded of the lapse of time." It's a lovely passage, and you use it to inspire one of the exercises, as you have in the title. There are 21 exercises for people to do, and I love this one, being such an audio-oriented person. It's draw a sound map. So describe what that exercise is.
Sure. I should backtrack a little and say that this book is just one of a series, a long-running series by Chicago Review Press, the 4 Kids series. Mm. They've been doing this for more than 20 years, and they have all kinds of personal biographies, you know, Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, Shakespeare, Beethoven, and movements as well, American Revolution for kids, Civil War, World War I, World War II, Great Depression, the Civil Rights Movement, all these books for kids, and they're all tailored to be a basic biography with 21 relevant activities. So it's a hands-on way for middle school students to get a flavor of what this person did. And the activity that you're talking about, the sound map, is something that outdoor educators do. And that is go outside, and it really doesn't even matter if you're in a natural place or in a civilized place, we'll say, with lots of people around. It could be interesting either way. Get a piece of paper, hold it lengthwise across so it's wider. Draw yourself in the middle. The way I do it is a little different than it says in the book. But draw yourself in the middle and then just listen. Ideally, you're supposed to be in that position for as many minutes as years you are alive. So if you're 12 years old, you stand there for 12 minutes and you listen. And when you hear something like a bird to your left, then draw it on the paper. If you don't know what is making the sound, make, you know, like brrr or chirpy, chirpy, chirp, or whatever you think the sound is. So just be quiet and listen. See how many different things you hear. I like to use this exercise myself when we first go out and we do nature writing walks where we're going to experience things and write about them. I think it's a great way to pay attention to things that we are used to ignoring, really. You know, background noises all the time, a dog barking in the distance, a truck backing up in the distance, you know, cars on a highway, a plane going over, rustling in the leaves by a squirrel that you didn't even notice was there. You know, I think we're so oriented with vision. Those of us who are sighted, we are so oriented with what we see first, that to take time and listen is something that we rarely do. And Henry was all about paying attention, waking up, paying attention, being deliberate. So that's I knew I had to include that kind of thing. And most of the over half of the 21 activities in the book draw the children outside. We know that there is a environmental education movement called No Child Left Inside. And
it's crazy.
And so we want kids, you know, people who grew up in the 60s and 70s and beforehand, before people were so connected to television and inside activities or video games or whatever inside, you know, we went outside, we played, we made our own games, we explored the little creek in the empty lot next to us. We climb trees. You know, there's the complaint that people don't do that much anymore. Children don't do that much anymore. So most of the activities in here are the kinds of things that Thoreau would do, but it also gets people outside and paying attention to what's around them.
And that was Corinne Smith talking about her book, Henry David Thoreau for Kids, His Life and Ideas with 21 Activities. Go to writersvoice.net for a web-only extra of our interview with Corinne Smith.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.